is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We've heard some really hopeful news from North Korea. In fact, the way CBS characterized it, the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, wants to make a commitment to a war-free peninsula without any nuclear weapons. Let's consult Tom Countryman, who is the chairman of the Arms Control Association and former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for International Security and Nonproliferation. What's your read on this, Tom?
I'm reluctant to call the summit between the two Korean leaders a breakthrough. It was certainly a step forward in that it agreed on certain steps that will reduce tension between the two Koreas, that will reduce the risk of an accidental conflict along the border. And those are positive steps. But whether it made any progress towards the denuclearization, that is the United States goal, that is the complete elimination of nuclear weapons in North Korea, it's too early to say. It did accomplish an important thing, which is it moved the ball sufficiently that the U.S. and North Korea are now going to resume direct contact. And that's essential if we're going to get to an agreement.
Now, was there a stalemate where the two were not talking to each other?
Well, as you recall, last month, President Trump canceled a scheduled visit by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, to Pyongyang. And then that was on hold until this recent summit. Now the two sides have agreed that they're going to meet at the Secretary of State's level in New York next week. And then the new special negotiator for the United States, Steve Biegun, will meet with his counterparts from North Korea in Vienna very soon. So a gap of a month or more in direct high-level communication is coming to an end. This is a long, slow process. And I'm not sure that the president understands that such a detailed agreement is going to take a lot of time. There are not dramatic steps that happen overnight.
So what was in this agreement that Kim Jong-un signed with the president of South Korea?
Well, first, between the two Koreas, North Korea and South Korea, there was an important military agreement. They will take certain steps to ensure that an incident at the border doesn't immediately provoke a military response from either side. Keep in mind, the nuclear war threat in Korea that I worry about is something simple turning into a conventional conflict and then that escalating to a nuclear conflict. So de-escalating tension between the two Koreas along the border is a good thing and a step well worth taking. But in terms of what Mr. Kim has offered to President Moon, it is, as I said, just enough to keep the process going. That is explicitly stating that he would shut down the reactor that has produced most of the plutonium for North Korea's nuclear bombs. That, however, was immediately conditioned upon the U.S. taking certain steps. So the impasse remains that the North Koreans expect the U.S. to make a declaration that the Korean War is over, and then we can move on denuclearization. And the U.S. expects North Korea to take certain steps on denuclearization, and then we can talk about treaties that formally end the war. That impasse, in one sense, is still there, but there was enough accomplished this week that we can get back to the only realistic solution, which is both sides laying out a step-by-step process to address the other side's concerns.
Now, as I recall, you've told me that the way North Korea is going to define denuclearization, they are not going to dismantle their program to the point of no return. They would do it to the point of a possible return. Are you still sticking with that?
Yeah, I would still stick with that assessment. I mean, it would be a terrific accomplishment if the United States, in partnership with South Korea, could convince North Korea to give up all of the nuclear weapons it has manufactured. And keep in mind, we don't know exactly how many weapons it has made. That would be a great achievement. If you can get beyond that and get North Korea to give up all of its capability to make plutonium or to make enriched uranium, that would be a fantastic achievement on top of the first. I don't think you ever get to the point where you erase from the brains of North Korean scientists and engineers all knowledge about how to make a nuclear weapon. At the moment, I think that Mr. Pompeo, in seeking for this maximum goal to be achieved by the end of the current U.S. president's term, is overstating what is actually achievable. We should be looking for smaller bites to get us closer to that eventual goal.
Tom Countryman is the chairman of the Arms Control Association and former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for International Security and Nonproliferation. Tom, thanks.
Thank you, Dave.
A deadline passed about 7 minutes ago. The Senate Judiciary Committee gave Dr. Christine Blasey Ford until 7 o'clock to decide whether she'll testify against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. We don't know what the decision is. The president, meanwhile, hasn't had much to say about her until last night. We called up CBS News congressional correspondent Nancy Cordes.
It is certainly a marked departure from the way that he has talked about other people who have thwarted his particular goals, but he has been restrained. He is clearly sticking to a script, as most folks at the White House have been, saying that she deserves to be heard, and they are okay delaying the process a bit. But last night in Las Vegas, he also said, hey, well, why didn't she come forward and talk to the FBI 36 years ago? Why is she only doing it now? And we really need to get on with things. Yeah. So some of his frustration is beginning to show.
Well, I can see why she might not want to talk to the FBI 36 years ago when she was 15 years old. Mm-hmm. But explain why she initially said, I want to testify, and then began attaching conditions.
You know, that is an excellent question. Initially, she said she's willing to do anything she needs to do to get her story out there. It's possible once she was faced with the white hot public spotlight, she got nervous, as a lot of private citizens would have, and her lawyers began to sense that without any conditions whatsoever, this could be a process that was not entirely fair to her. Remember that sexual assault, alleged sexual assault, is not an issue that should be particularly partisan, and yet it is being dropped into an extremely partisan debate over the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. So you can have 11 Republicans on that Judiciary Committee with every motivation to try to poke holes in her credibility and in her story. And then, of course, you'll have 10 Democrats on the committee who have that same motivation to poke holes in Judge Kavanaugh's defense. So this is a very, very political process. And her lawyers say they are just trying to ensure that she is treated with respect and with fairness.
Now, some people argue that this question about sexual harassment has been asked and answered because, in fact, Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii asked it during the hearing, and here's what he said under oath.
Since you became a legal adult, have you ever made unwanted requests for sexual favors or committed any verbal or physical harassment or assault of a sexual nature?
No.
Now, he answered no, but she had prefaced that question with the phrase, since you became a legal adult, and this would have happened before mm-hmm. that. Do you think
Correct.
That, yeah, so is he possibly finessing this? I mean, what's the talk off the air around Capitol Hill? Are they saying, yeah, there might be something there, or she is clearly making this up for some as yet unknown reason?
You know what? It really runs the gamut. There are a lot of Republican senators who believe him inherently. Keep in mind, he's someone who they have known for 10, 15 years. You know, he's been a judge for a long time. He's here in Washington, D.C. So there are a lot of Republican senators who know him and trust him. And they say, you know, I don't think he would lie about this. And I believe him. You know, and then there are a lot of folks in the middle who say, look, how can I know what really happened here? But I also don't know that you can ever have an investigation that would get to the truth because this happened so long ago. So views really really run the gamut. And I think the challenge for everyone here is, even if there is a hearing that is, you know, incredibly contentious, where are we at the end of that process? Obviously, she will say it happened. He will say it didn't happen. Yeah. And then people are left to make up their minds. And that's why you have Democrats who are demanding an independent investigation to buttress what's being said in the hearing.
All that has to happen is for he's agreed to testify again Monday under oath. So Senator Hirono simply needs to take the preface off her question. Instead of saying, since you became a legal adult, she could ask, at any time during your life, have you ever committed any verbal or physical harassment or assault of a sexual nature?
Sure. And we know what he'll say to that, because he has very strenuously denied these allegations and denied ever behaving this way from the very beginning. So we have every reason to expect that that's what he will continue to say in the hearing. And unless some witness comes forward and says, no, I did see this happen, or I spoke with Christine Blasey Ford at the time, she told me about it, you know, then it is going to remain a pretty murky situation, especially because Blasey Ford did talk to a therapist 5 or 6 years ago about this. She has therapist notes, but Republicans don't want to call that therapist to testify. They also don't want to call Mark Judge, who is the other man who Blasey Ford says was in the room when this happened. They don't want to call him to testify publicly as well. He has denied knowing anything about it in a written statement, and he says he doesn't want to testify.
CBS News congressional correspondent Nancy Cordes. Amazing how this music from my youth keeps popping up.
That's right. James is so clever.
Yes, he is. Film critic Tom Tangney is here with our Friday film review, The House with a Clock in Its Walls.
That's right. Kind of a clunky title, but it is based on something of a children's lit classic, if you consider something that was written in 1973 classic material. The House with a Clock in Its Walls is a PG movie that doesn't want to be too scary or too funny or apparently too interesting. And it succeeds on all three fronts. Another way of saying this is that it's not scary enough and not funny enough and certainly not interesting enough for most adults. Kids won't mind, of course, as 10-year-olds are clearly the target audience. Conveniently, the hero of our story is himself 10 years old. His name is Lewis, and following the death of his parents, isn't that the way these children's stories always go, he's sent to stay with his eccentric Uncle Jonathan, played by Jack Black, in inimitable Jack Black way, who lives in the creepiest of Victorian mansions. The house is overstuffed with hundreds of ticking clocks, automatons, living furniture, secret passageways, books of magic, even stained glass windows that move. But as unnerving as the house is to Lewis, the house rules are the stuff of every kid's dream.
Don't I have to have dinner before I'm allowed to have cookies?
Well, why not just eat cookies for dinner? They're far more delicious.
I know, it's just, we have these house rules.
Well, not in this house. There's no bedtime, bath time, or meal time. You can eat cookies till you throw up for all I care. You'll see. Things are quite different here.
And if that isn't enough to delight a child, the mansion's garden features a giant topiary griffin who farts up a storm of leaves.
What smells of rancid sulfur?
Bad kitty!
Does every kid's Bad movie kitty. Have to have?
Not everyone, maybe, but a lot of them do. And you'll like this, too. When a bunch of pumpkins come to life and threaten Lewis and Jonathan and his neighbor, Mrs. Zimmerman, played by the great Kate Blanchett, the jack-o'-lanterns attack in a way that's sure to delight the little ones.
Oh, my giddy aunt.
Don't worry, their teeth are made of pumpkin. They can't really hurt us.
God, I hate pumpkins.
Yes, the pumpkins vomit up their orange innards all over their victims, much like the celebrities who get slimed with green goop at the Nickelodeon's Kids' Choice Awards. Now, the actual clock in the wall that gives the movie and the book that it's based on its title gets relatively short shrift in the film. It's a hidden clock that portends some kind of doom, But the movie is more concerned with Lewis's sidebar escapades at school and at the cemetery. These escapades involve Lewis learning the arts of magic from Jonathan and Mrs. Zimmerman. These two parental figures have some very parental advice for the boy.
It's not what you say, Lewis. It's how you say it. You're the only you in the whole universe.
That makes your style of magic just crazy unique. 1 in 100 million kajillion. So I can give you the right books, teach you the right spells, but that last 1%, that's up to you.
So, how do I find my magic style or whatever it is?
It's in there somewhere. You just have to quiet down and listen. Now it looks like you're pooping.
Always with the joke.
Oh, yeah.
When the mystery of the clock is finally revealed, it becomes clear the story might have been psychologically deeper than we'd assumed, but ultimately the film seems more interested in kid-friendly shocks and giggles than in any overarching theme, just like any 10-year-old would want.
How many tangs, Tom?
Out of 4, Dave, I'll give it 2.5.
That's the half. Thank you, Tom.
I hear you, Dave. Bye-bye.
Time for a Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. How often is it that a number one draft pick actually walks out and plays like a number one draft pick? That's what happened in Cleveland.
It is not frequent, especially when you're talking about a quarterback. And Baker Mayfield took the field last night and was awesome. He came into the game. He wasn't even allowed to compete for the starting job at the beginning of the season because Tyrod Taylor is the quarterback they had there. And Tyrod suffered a concussion in the first half. Baker Mayfield came in, and I don't think you'll see him leave because he looked really good. Their offense came to life, the building came to life, and they won for the first time since 2016.
And explain the free beer thing to me.
Bud Light, in a marketing campaign that was beautiful, sent victory coolers to a list of Cleveland bars that would be opened by remote control as soon as the Browns won. Now, I don't know if all those beers have stayed fresh. They used to have born-on dates.
Yeah,
so
right.
No, but I think it was for this season. So, yeah. So coolers were opened up, and I'm sure there was a mad stampede of people to grab their free beer.
What is it that the Browns offense have that we don't?
Well, that's a great question, Colleen, and that's a troubling one as well. They had some rhythm. They had some excitement. They were able to move the ball yesterday. We'll see. Seattle's got a challenge. Dallas comes in here, and Seattle's at home, and I think there's more at stake in this regular season game than it's one of the most important regular season games in Pete Carroll's 9 seasons, because if they lose this, if they lose at home, you feel like the bottom has dropped out and that this season won't be about can they get to the playoffs? Can they contend? It's going to become about, are we seeing any progress? Is it going to get worse before it gets better? And they've got a Dallas team that has a pretty good pass rush. They have 9 sacks in 2 games, and the Seahawks have allowed 12, most in the league so far. So that's not a promising sign. And then you throw in injuries. Their starting center and their starting left guard have both been out from practice this week because of injuries, so that's not great either.
Chris Carson's going to be in?
Chris Carson is.
Actually, didn't Pete apologize for not playing him as much?
Correct. He didn't play after the midway point of the second quarter. He carried 6 times in the first 20 minutes, and then we didn't see him again.
Yeah.
And Pete said he thought he was gassed, and I don't think anyone believes that. And Pete then later said, I misread the situation, and I don't think anybody believes that either, that something happened, and I think Pete is raising his hand to take the blame for the reason he was unavailable. I don't think it was Pete's fault.
So do they need the paddles? I mean, is there... Let me ask you this. Just
the
to sort
paddles?
Of,
you like, know, clear?
Yeah.
Like, you want him to get out there and jumpstart? Who do you want to apply the paddles to?
I don't know.
Not Russell, man. He's been beat up enough so far. We don't need to be shocking him.
But you got to shake it up somehow. And I was reading about the history of the shotgun formation just because I do strange things from time to time. Do you always have to snap it to the quarterback? If you're going to do a running play, why couldn't you just trick him and snap it right to the running back, and then he gets right out there before the blockers can stop him?
You mean a direct snap?
I don't know, whatever you call it.
Yes. Yeah, you can do that.
Well, then why not do that? Or why do you always have to snap it straight back? Can't you snap it back at an angle, really screw up the defense?
Now, that would be problematic, because the reason it snaps straight back is you've got protection on both sides of the line.
Yeah.
You've got 5 men who are committed, 5 300-pound men whose only job is to protect Russell. So you want him right in the middle of those 5 guys. You wouldn't want him on one side, because then the defense could stack it on that side. Yeah, they can do some things. You know what I would say they should do? They should stop huddling. They should accelerate the tempo. They should give Russell as much freedom. I think that we're too obsessed about the run game. I think what people are thinking, like, they said they were going to run it, and they need to run it. No, when they've moved it best this season, when they've moved it best, it's been Russell moving.
When it's an emergency.
Yes. Let's get that. Or maybe.
Well, now it is an emergency.
Maybe convince them. Maybe convince the team that they're down 14 points to start the game. Because when they're down double digits, they tend to do really well. So just tell them and say, we don't know what happened. We thought the start time was wrong. The other team's already scored 14 points. We're down by 14 to begin the game. And then see if that helps.
Since this is Dave's 1-year-long celebration of 40 years at Cairo Radio, we got to throw out the first pitch. I think that you should pinch hit as a coach, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to see him play quarterback.
Guest coach.
How do you think you would do behind Seattle's offensive line?
As long as none of the passes have to be more than 60 feet, I'd be fine.
Well, you can just choose to run. Do you think you'd be able to evade these 280-pound carnivores?
I was just asking, how many 300-pound people did you say there were on the
Five.
Front line there? Is there a wide enough space between their legs that I could sort of sneak underneath them?
Yes, but you can't touch your knee down.
Oh, you can't touch your knee
no,
down?
No, because then you'd be down, and we
when
want
they,
you to gain positive
they have
yardage.
That rule. Can we talk about the arena just briefly?
Oh. Sure.
Because apparently it's a go.
I mean,
they passed the deadline, and nobody raised an environmental reservation about it.
How did that happen?
I'm trying to figure that out.
The Seattle process? Were they asleep?
Did anybody care about the carbon footprint or anything?
I know. Wasn't there some salamander that they could try to preserve that they were worried
about? Some rare
species
in Lower Queen Anne that might be...
In a rare demonstration of common sense, Seattle has not boondoggled its own project.
Yeah.
It appears to be absolutely amazing. Maybe... This group, the Oakview group, is so buttoned down and together that they've headed off any potential objections. I count myself amazed.
Yeah, okay. I just want to confirm that actually happened because when I read the headline, I couldn't believe it.
Well, it debunks one of my top nickname suggestions for the hockey team, though.
What was that?
I wanted them to be the Seattle Process. Like when they have to kill a penalty, like the Seattle Process. The Seattle Process has taken effect and just stall and stall and stall. But you know what? Like there's no Seattle Process going on.
Oh, it seems there's no team either yet. Right?
So we should follow Mike Lewis's suggestion and call them the Rent Hikes.
The Rent Hikes.
The Seattle Rent Hikes.
And you know what you call a goon on that team? The Process Servers.
Boo!
Now you're over.
Hey, I just came up with that. Come on, give me my synapses are firing.
Hear the crickets.
Thank you, Danny.
Talk to you soon.
Your Seattle Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Can Seattle's big tech companies like Amazon help solve the homeless crisis? Mayor Jenny Durkin thinks so, and so she formed an advisory board to come up with some possibilities. They met for the first time yesterday. Hannah Scott is here to report on it. And this came out of the whole head tax debacle, right?
Well, and the mayor has said that's not why that this came up, but it did right after the head tax failed earlier this year. That was a big fight throughout the spring. This is when Mayor Jenny Durkin announced her new advisory council to help find new ways that tech companies like Amazon could help with the issue of homelessness and transportation. Now, the Innovation Advisory Council includes executives from Expedia, Twitter, Facebook, Microsoft, and of course Amazon, as well as several other tech companies. Most don't have a lot in the way of experience on dealing with homelessness. They held their inaugural meeting yesterday, described to me by the mayor's office as more like a meet and greet, getting things started. When the mayor announced this panel last month, she said while technology cannot solve the homeless crisis, it does have a role to play. And she suggested at that time that one possibility would be maybe an app that helps direct people on the streets into homeless shelters. But there are skeptics, including Candace Faber. Now, she used to lead the city's civic tech initiatives department and the IT department, and she told GeekWire right before this meeting that this was the wrong approach and that if the answer to the problem was an app, it would not be tough to build that.
Well, I mean, one of the problems is that there already are people inviting them to go to homeless shelters, but they don't want to because there are too many rules.
Right, yeah. So another issue that Candace raised in the GeekWire article is that there's really no set clear guidelines or accountability from this tech advisory panel. So at yesterday's meeting, the mayor kind of warned expectations should be realistic. To be clear, there is no app, she said, that's going to fix anything. But she also said that the city would be missing a great opportunity if it didn't use the bright leaders of the tech industry that are right here in our backyard as part of this solution. One of the tech experts at this meeting told the Seattle Times they'd like to help with maybe analyzing data on why people become homeless, while others said that they'd like some to get more information from groups on the ground working to combat homelessness. So we're talking a lot about data analyzing.
We have all the data.
Well,
we hired a consultant who gathered all the data. So we know where people come from. We know how many are coming from other states. How many are born here. Most of them are born here. How many have drug problems. We have all the data.
I would tend to agree with that, and I don't. We haven't, again. There has not been a real clear.
Did anybody
outline
mention the idea of at some point you have to just say no, you can't camp here?
Nope,
that did not.
Not in this panel or any others that I've actually been monitoring over the last week or so. There was there's a lot of different meetings going on. There was King County Board of Health had a meeting yesterday where they passed some non-binding recommendations for all of the various municipalities on ways to respond to homelessness. Not a lot there we haven't heard before, but nobody talking about kicking people off of camping on the streets.
I don't use the word kicking, inviting people to move elsewhere. The text message controversy, the texts between the mayor and certain movers and shakers like Nick Hanauer being fired all over the place during this head tax debate. They were released because there was a media
suit. It's a couple of different lawsuits for claiming that the city has violated the Open Public Meetings Act by deciding to repeal the head tax in private, not in public.
So apparently these were all people talking behind Shama Sawant's back, basically, right?
Behind each other's back. I don't think it's all just, right? So you've got the mayor. So essentially what it sounds like happened is that there was some polling numbers that came out right after the city had passed the head tax, and they were dismal. The people did not support.
Who ran that poll, by the way?
And I don't know that off the top of my head.
EMC was the firm that did it, but you don't know who commissioned it.
I don't know who commissioned that poll. But the text messages all happened right after that, which would have been the weekend right before they very abruptly repealed that tax, I believe, on a Monday morning or Monday afternoon. And you have exchanges between Mayor Durkin and Nick Hanauer saying the right thing to do is to go ahead and repeal this. It's clear that there's been some sort of discussion between them.
David Rolf, too, of SEIU, the union.
Yeah, big labor boss, Service Employees International. Also, there are some exchanges between Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez and one of her aides. One of the big takeaways I took from these text messages is the big divide that there seems to be between the city council members and the mayor's office, which was pretty clear also during all of the head tax debate.
Well, what I took away from it was how influential that poll was. Once they saw the results from that poll, almost instantly the messages started flying. So for those of you who got that telephone call for that poll, you're the guys who changed their minds. And most of us blow off those calls.
Right. So, and they work. So, if you're feeling passionate about something and you have something to say, by all means, weigh in. That division still comes. It'll be interesting. We have both... We should get some new information here this next week about where we're going to be spending our money as far as homelessness goes. The mayor's budget's due out next week. Yeah. There start discussions on that on Monday, and as well as King County Council Executive Dale Constantine also releasing his details on Monday. So we'll maybe see where some of the money's going. I'm still waiting to see where some of our money has been going as far as housing, services department that give money to like Lehigh and the agencies that we have where we have tent campments and city sanctioned campments about whether they're meeting their bars. I'm still waiting for the second quarter numbers from that as well.
All right, it's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Could we see dramatically cheaper drug prices in the coming months? We may, because of the way the trade war is working out between us and Canada. As you know, President Trump slapped tariffs on Canadian products. He's insulted their prime minister, threatening to cut them out of the NAFTA deal. Those tariffs on aluminum and steel are really hurting Canada because they produce more aluminum than any other country in the world. And now the president has threatened tariffs on Canadian cars as well, which would basically shut down the Canadian auto industry. And all this has placed normally placid Canadians in an angry mood. And that's why we called a man who's been advising the Canadian government on what to do next.
Where I think it really is clear and deeply offensive is... What Trump had to do to apply those steel and aluminum tariffs to Canada, right? He declared us a national security threat. So the only way Trump could, under U.S. law, bypass NAFTA and have a fig leaf that he was acting legally, which he isn't, but he wanted the fig leaf anyway, was to say that we're suspending Canada's benefits of low tariffs because Canada's a national security threat. That national security threat designation to affect trade has only ever been used against Syria, Iran, and North Korea. And now it's being used against Canada. This is a country that has spilled blood. There are dead Canadian soldiers who fought alongside American soldiers. And we're a national security threat to the U.S.? That's deeply offensive.
Professor Amir Attaran teaches law and health policy at the University of Ottawa, and he says Canadians are ticked off about this, and so it's his job to figure out what they can do to fight back. Now, we've seen that China has retaliated by targeting its own tariffs at Donald Trump's constituents, like pork farmers in Iowa and bourbon makers in Kentucky. But Canada's economy is much smaller, so they have to be a little sneakier. And that's why Professor Attaran came up with a whole new strategy. He's proposed that Canada go after the U.S. companies with the most lobbying power. He's proposed that they go after Big Pharma.
The pharma industry in the U.S., as you know, is massive, and it has greater political clout than any other industry in the United States. One of the surprising facts I unearthed when I did my research is that pharma spends more on lobbying Washington than the defense industry and the banking industry combined.
So what the professor is proposing that his country do is to start ignoring U.S. pharmaceutical patents. It's something called compulsory licensing, which legally allows a government like Canada's to assert eminent domain over intellectual property.
If you're, for argument's sake, you are Eli Lilly, and Eli Lilly has a patent on a valuable, lucrative, money-spinning drug in Canada, but there's a generic alternative made elsewhere in the world, and for pretty much every single drug, there are generics elsewhere in the world. You know, under the patent that Eli Lilly has in Canada, you're not allowed to import that cheaper generic. You're not allowed to make that cheaper generic in Canada either. So manufacturing in Canada is out of the question. Importation from outside Canada is also out of the question. But once there's a compulsory license on that patent, you can do both.
Which means Canadian companies could begin manufacturing cheap generic versions of any American drug, like Viagra. Or they can make generic EpiPens, outflanking the American patents that force us to pay exorbitant prices for drugs that cost very little to produce. And the best part is, most of us would welcome that. We could buy cheap drugs from Canada. Leave it to the Canadians to punish us with kindness. It would even help the president keep a promise which he has so far ignored, that is, to bring down the price of prescription drugs. Sounds too good to be true. And it is.
Sure, if they want to come and, you know, buy some drugs and then, you know, have a lunch and enjoy Niagara Falls and go back, yeah. I mean, you know, whether that's legal for them to do under U.S. law is a different question, right? We in Canada would be prepared to sell it to them. Whether they can bring it into the U.S. is a different issue.
And they're willing to mail it to us, yes.
It's happening. It's been happening for years. Now, it's not legal in the U.S., right? And from time to time, American law enforcement agents shut that sort of thing down. But it can happen.
So we could benefit from this Canadian tactic. But number one, you'd have to break the law to do it. And number two, he's hoping it never comes to that. What he's hoping is that Big Pharma does what it always does, unleash the lobbyists on Capitol Hill to beg, plead, and threaten members of Congress in hopes they will force the president to remove the aluminum tariffs so the drug companies can continue gouging us and Canada can save its aluminum industry.
How many hundreds of lobbyists from the pharma industry be crawling all over the Capitol trying to prevent that happening? That's a sad reality of how powerful the lobby is in the States. American drug prices are the highest in the world.
But then how cynical is that? Tease us with the prospect of lower drug prices for the sole purpose of getting rid of the aluminum tariffs. Of course, that's why they call it war. Amir Attaran is a professor of law and health policy at the University of Ottawa, who's advising the Canadian government on its trade negotiations.